Imperium Cast. This week with a special guest, our first guest on the new podcast, great friend of the show and the channel,
Tyler Hamilton.
You can find him at his YouTube channel. I'll put a link in the description. I'll also put a link to his Twitter, his Telegram. Check out Tyler's channel. If you scroll back in some of the old videos, you'll see my ugly head on quite a few of them, actually. He's got a lot of great content, including a recent podcast that he just launched with another friend of the show called Theopolitics. As the name suggests, they deal with the relationship between theology and politics. And I would kind of like this discussion to end up going in that direction. But Tyler also is very much into embodied cognition, phenomenology, and I wanted to get him on here to begin by giving us his analysis of AI, because it seems like AI is this really central technology to the modern condition, and in my view, emblematic of the contemporary spiritual, political, technological perspective. And so I think analyzing AI is key to really understanding the situation that we find ourselves in, ultimately, as a society. So with that, I'm just going to throw it to Tyler.
Awesome. Well, thanks for having me back on, Joel and Mike. It's been good to talk to you guys again. It's been quite a while, so certainly nice to be here. And just to jump straight into this question, we could really summarize this whole issue with the state of most philosophy of mind today, which is really a shared set of presumptions that exist across both dualistic and physicalist notions of mind. And so an easy way to think about this problem is look at Daniel Dennett's brain in a vat mission thought experiment. Now, of course, he didn't come up with the brain in the vat thought experiment, but he does push it further with his own particular version of it. And it's a good instructive case to use when we're talking about critiques of current philosophy of mind and AI. And so basically what this is that we can stimulate parts of the brain responsible for registering sensory information, and then we apparently have the exact same experience as if we were really experiencing these sensations. And in Dennett's version, the process of your brain in a vat receiving electrodes about the world is a very dangerous process. Then suddenly this person undergoing this experiment, their body ends up dying. So these surgeons, these operators that are testing on them end up providing them with a brand new body. And just like surgery, there's a small adjustment process, but then it starts to feel like home. All the operators needed to do was copy the brain structure and information and connect it to some new hardware. And so the brain then is unable to really feel a difference between the body and the computer. So what the point here is that the body is not a necessary condition for cognition. What matters is not really the brain either, actually, but it's the software and the information that generates cognitive life. So if you have the right information, then the replicating syntax machines can run and thus generate conscious experience. So a robotic body can also be a stand-in here for the physical body, because as we see from this example, if we accept this view of the mind, then the physical body is not actually necessary. Right. And so you actually have a big contingent of neuroscientists that even argue that the body only matters as its own representation in the somatosensory cortex. Now, so basically what we're having here is a localized representational view of the brain as an information processor, which this is something you actually find very Cartesian, even though advocates of this don't want to hear that. And also this is something that postmodernists also have in common, which again is something they don't really want to hear. So just to make this a wider metaphysical question, which goes back, of course, to the deeper questions we're trying to aim at with this, is that when you look at the Cartesian worldview, is you have this soul that never actually appears. You have this extended body and the soul is interacting with it, but not reducible to it. So then how is that the same as the physicalist position? Well, the point is that the soul never actually appears as its own mode of cognition with the world in the sense of an experiencing subject. Instead, it's processing and experiencing the body and essentially acting as a driver for it, but nonetheless, it's not reducible to it, and the question of how exactly it interacts with the body is not made clear. But you get this same kind of shared perspective where all the way up to Kant, you get this self that synthesizes various experiences in the world according to the relations of quantity, quality, relation, and modality, which take the matter of the world and construct it according to these categories, but nonetheless, the thinking I never actually appears. It's always some foundational base. Now, when you get to postmodernism, you actually largely have the same answer. Like in Heidegger's view, you have death as the motivation for the conscious self that drives you out of bed in the morning. But death, of course, is an absence, right? In Derrida, you have différence, where the originary experience is never actually comprehended in its fullness. It's always a series of representation and standing in for representation. And of course, I'm consciously changing his use of the word science just to tie it in to neuroscience. So the self and the conscious experiencing subject in the world never actually appears. Now, when you get to the current state of neuroscience, and of course not all of them, because some of them do have good embodied views, but regardless, the mainstream view is that you essentially have a cognitive Kantianism. You have where the body just acts as this receptacle to receive sensation, and then it becomes synthesized and processed according to a series of representations in the brain. And then you can then construct the whole of the conscious experience from that. So you have information processing. You have language of computational metaphor being transplanted into a localized internal view of the mind. And then so the aspiration here for artificial intelligence then, which they share with both dualists and the postmodernists, is that dualists would be critical of this, but the shared assumptions are there, just to clarify. But regardless, what that assumption is if you can replicate that internal site of representation according to modes of information processing in a computer, you can then say, for example, upload it onto a computer and have an experiencing conscious subject full of all the memories which are somehow localized and represented within certain rooms in the mind that houses various sensations. And of course, you get to questions of overextending fMRI experiments and all this stuff to try to pull this and make this a coherent story. So you have a self then that is away from time, is away from a conscious engagement with the world, with actional affordances with the world. And it becomes something that's capable of being removed and abstracted and taken like a snapshot, basically. And this is where you get the current dreams of a lot of artificial intelligence. Now, of course, people might say, well, what about like adding, for example, something to your eye so you could see with an artificial eye or something like that? That's not really what we're saying, because you'll notice a lot of people, when they try to argue for transhumanism or an artificial intelligence futures, they tend to confuse automation or extended limbs and things like this and say, well, we're recreating the human. That's not really true, right? But there are stronger proponents, and it all goes back to these same clear assumptions. So what the embodied mind is meant to overcome is this whole dualism itself by replacing these abstract notions of mind and the body. So basically, as the great French phenomenologist Maurice Merleau-Ponty has argued, that the body is not physiological or psychological, right? We're not talking about the body in that sense. We're talking about the body as a principle of experience. So a helpful distinction then is the Husserlian one between the objective body and the lived body. The objective body are two ways we experience things, right? So imagine yourself having an out-of-body experience and or like a near-death experiencing, and you're viewing your body, right? You're talking about an intentional, reflective look at the body versus, say, the lived body, the one in which kinesthetic and proprioceptive action constitutes the way in which that self becomes engage in the world and how you understand yourself. So in other words, we're collapsing abstract notions of mind and body, and we're replacing representational accounts of consciousness. And this is where it becomes very problematic for AI, because if we're right, then their aspirations are simply false. And I mean, AI is in strong AI, not AI is in a computer or an automated worker or something, right? So that's a basic introduction to where I'm going. There's a lot more I could say about the specifics of embodied cognition and actually argue for. I'll just take a quick break there before I pick back up into it and let you guys jump in.
I just wanted to also ask you then, because the instinctive reaction that I have to AI, why I kind of rejected it most fundamentally, I mean, there's more arguments than this, but the most fundamental argument that struck me is simply like trying to imagine how a deterministic algorithm can ultimately produce it can kind of produce itself in any sense, because any kind of deterministic system, its parameters have to be preset, and so it can't ever account for its own genesis or its own creation. And so any state of mind, any thought, would have to be volitionless. There's no space for any free will or even self-reflexivity. I think you'd have to be a hard determinist to even have faith in AI, which I'm not, and done many videos on my channel on the philosophy of Bergson and Deleuze. They go in different, very different directions, but ultimately make a series of very strong arguments, I think, for spinning the deterministic view of consciousness. And it also relates to the idea that language can't process itself. I mean, ultimately, it has to be set by some prior agency into a relation. And so how does this fit in? Because the only way in which you can really imagine, in my view, consciousness as a system that embodies agency or that expresses agency is for it to be indeterminate, for there to be a ability for it to act outside of what has already occurred. There has to be a space for the generation of the new. Otherwise, what's the point of even thinking? Or like, why would we even, like, thought just seems to be just, would just necessarily be this kind of automatic process, like, which is already what we have with a computer or with a robot or what have you. But if there is a qualitative distinction between human consciousness and these kinds of deterministic systems, it seems like AI would have to overcome this and figure out how to model this. And as far as I can tell, there seems to be a kind of lack in this regard.
Yeah, no, I certainly agree with all that. I mean, one of the things is this is a lesson that certain advocates of artificial intelligence, especially at MIT, have tried to incorporate, but they don't seem to quite get it. So like back in the day, you had Hubert Dreyfus arguing from a Heideggerian perspective about why consciousness is not reducible to this deterministic set of algorithms that you can reproduce in a way that can be measured and controlled and then propagated somewhere outside the physical body that's engaged with the world and a meaningful world at that. And you still see that now, actually. Like someone like Rodney Brooks, who's also at MIT, basically tries to look at the role of biology and biologically inspired sensory motor machines and basically argues that the body acts according to a set of rules. So basically bodies are like robots. Of course, this is still a Cartesian view, by the way, because the body acts as physical automata, right? So I think you're quite apt in that description. There's nothing I would change in it. I would just try to deepen this a little bit, though, to try to get to explain for the audience what the difference in modes of consciousness we're talking about here, us versus proponents of AI. So imagine like a fielder trying to catch a ball, right? And according to the representational account, that would be a problem that's solved in the fielder's head. So the speed and trajectory of the ball are reconstructed by the brain, which solves the problem offline and then sends instructive signals to the limbs and representational accounts. Then, because they have this description of cognition, basically treat cognition post-perceptually, right? But the way we talk about in embodied cognition, not having representation, right? We're talking about how vision and movement are an act of the fielder that's running on a line, keeping up with the ball's trajectory through the visual field at constant speed, right? So there's no computing in the head representations that these are dynamical sensory motor processes that are online, and anticipation is a part of that action itself, right? So anticipation requiring a future state linkage with the body with the ball. While representational accounts, on the other hand, try to detach from that proprioceptive input. And that's where you get with this deterministic outlook, is because if it's a sequence that's detached from your conscious experience of the world in a sense of action in the world, then it's ultimately being done for you. There's no sense of work or repetition being done, right? But when we talk about fitness in that, for example, we're talking about your repeated instances of fitness are not stored as representations for later use, but your system essentially becomes more attuned for further ball catching because you're reenacting the process with memory and imagination, right? So you're representing, you're not representing these. And you could scale up these processes to cognitive stages like imagining or remembering that does not decouple them into a representational process, but a reactivation of perceptual neural processes which were activated in the original experience. And so another way to think about this, of course, because you see me talk a lot about Husserlian time consciousness, which is a major part of pre-reflective experience. We talked about the primal impression. We talked about the retention and the protension. And another way you can think about this in a particularly embodied cognition and measured way is to compare them to what we call the three time scales, right? So the elementary time scale is 10 and 100 milliseconds, which basically corresponds to the rhythms of bursting interneurons to the duration of an inhibitory or excitatory sequence of postsynaptic potential in the cortical pyramidal neuron. And so that's like the very, very micro level of time. time experience. But then you have the integrative scale, which is 0.5 to 3 seconds. So this is like an experience live present. It's like a fully constitutive motor operation, like you're reaching for something or you're grasping for something. And then you have the narrative scale, which is above 3 seconds. So that's like memory and more complex actions, right? Now, so how does this figure back into what we're talking about? Well, if you look at a lot of ways that people argue for artificial intelligence and the kind of experiments that they do, like you read them in popular science and popular psychology all the time, is they'll, for example, perform an fMRI, which essentially just measures the leaving of oxygen from blood in the brain, right? And then they see where it lights up according to what they're measuring. And then they go, okay, well, there you go. We've explained, for example, love or anger or jealousy or something. It's really stupid stuff. But the assumption here is that they're capturing it in a single time frame, right? It's localized, it's a process, it's a law, it's information that they're measuring, right? But the problem, of course, is if we take the Husserlian pre-reflective time conscious awareness into this, the sense of the lived body is acting in accordance with the environment. And then you could even put that, as I did with the three time scales that we measured when it comes to neuronal activity, is these kinds of decisions and these kinds of relations that we have in the world. For example, like we're trying to measure love. Well, I mean, love also has jealousy. It has envy. It has anger. It has not loving that person for 5 minutes and then loving them again 5 minutes later. You simply can't capture it in a snapshot view that they try to do, right? And so if you put these things together, you have a view of the body, which is what we call the four E's, right? Now, before I get into that, what I'm saying is that deterministic outlook is based on snapshotting and information processing, on trying to stop time, essentially, right? But when we're talking about context, for example, what goes into love, we're talking about the intersubjective and community conscious, right? So a part of embodiment is also intersubjective. It's a category of social cultural analysis. Because, you know, you're born into a history, a time that has meaning for you. You're situated in the nature and the culture. So that's one aspect, right? Another aspect, because there's four E's, although sometimes people add more. There's embodiment, which just again means the role of the body. There's extended. So extended means, for example, things that aren't a part of your physical body, but they're not quite the environment either, but they're more like tools that become a part of that, a part of your own cognition. So that would be like a blind man's cane, for example, or a pen when you're writing in a notebook. But the blind man's cane is a better example because the relation to their senses and their inhibited senses from being blind is dramatically changed by being able to see and go through the world with a cane. And then embedded means embedded in context and environmental context. The point is that these different aspects of a body that's in the world literally make up what we call consciousness. You can't abstract one and not expect some kind of massive change, right? So in mind. So a way you can think about this is like there's body schematic disorders. Like there's an individual who is 19, I forget his name, but he lost feeling in his limbs from the neck down. Right. And he found that he couldn't control the direction of his movements. The only way he could control them was if he intensely reflected on them to try to get to what he wanted to grasp, what he wanted to touch, what he wanted to do. And that's because that natural action-oriented engagement with the world was cut off from him, right? So the way we can explain this is we can look at the brain that we have is shaped by the body and these environmental affordances, right? So that would be like a simple example is the upright standing position. So with that, you have the human anatomy and skeletal structure. The posture demands a shape and a structure of the foot, ankle, knee, hip, vertebral column, proportion of limbs, and a specific nervous and musculature system, as well as development unique to humans with the shoulders, arms, skull, and face. And so this anatomy helps define our world and how we move in it, so to speak. And these are called affordances, environmental affordances, which is an idea developed by James Gibson. And that's the idea that objects in the environment afford different actions depending on the kind of body that we have. So when it comes to human development, getting the upright posture is delayed as infants are required to learn it against gravity, right? And you can see that posture is related to sleep and wakefulness. You fall asleep, you fall down. In a relation with others, the upright posture is also how we maintain distance, distance from the ground and other people. It gives us an extended range of vision, the widening of the environmental horizon, the spatial framework for perception and action, and the posture for the of the hands for grasping, manipulating, and pointing into things. And this ends up introducing complexities to brain structure as well as our rational capacities. And in terms of perception, olfactory sense is less important and seeing becomes more so, unless, of course, you're the blind man with the cane, right? And you're freeing up the mouth for its other purposes and the hands for its own proficiency. And the jaw structure defines what we eat, but also develops phonetic muscles and allows for vocal language, which is a precondition for rationality, which even Aristotle could tell you, right? So the body pre-processes and filters sensory signals and post-processes signals that contribute to motor control. And so bodily movements are not limited and controlled at brain level, but engineered by the design and mobility of the muscles and the tendons and the relations to others, as well as the history of their use, as we saw in the field or example with fitness. And so the nervous system cannot process information that's not transduced by the periphery, nor can it command movements that are impossible. Now, there's a lot of examples of bodily cognition I could get into, but I think you're getting the idea here, is that when we're talking about embodied cognition, the thesis about, which is so radical, and we can get to the political dimensions as we go on, is that the mind and consciousness is made up of what are essentially autonomous networks, right? So when we're talking about the intersubjective community, we're talking about the history in which you're born into, we're talking about the body, we're talking about kinesthetic perception, we're talking about environmental affordances, we're talking about the brain. These things all play their own role. They're all autonomous, but at the same time, they interact with each other. And so a change in one of those structures is going to affect a change in another. So we talked about body schematic disorders, but you could also talk about cultural changes, right? Like the meaning of someone's birth to a community, or the lack of meaning when people are born into a community where they're not actually given any attention, or they have a history of family trauma or something, generational trauma. And that's going to change the nature of how they're cognitively wired, right? And you could also have bodily disorders. You could have, for example, and this is what is the real danger of AI and transhumanism. You could have aspirations from nerds in Silicon Valley about transhumanism. And you could even say, philosophically and scientifically speaking, it's not possible to upload consciousness onto a computer like they talk about in the singularity. But the very act of organizing culture and politics and policy around what matters is going to affect the change in how we view ourselves, and it's going to do so in an unhealthy way. So you could look to example neuroaesthetics or neural literature, the fact that in some English departments they're talking about, if you really want to understand Shakespeare, you have to understand the brain, right? Or if you want to have a proper functioning efficient city, you have to organize it in such a way in which could deliver oil rapidly, fast. It doesn't matter about having a kind of community that you can walk in and it's walkable, and you can, you know what I'm getting at. It reorients the self around notions of efficiency that, while they're made for the human, at least ostensibly speaking, they escape the human's control. And this is where you end up in a kind of destiny. This is where you end up in a fate where you tie yourself to the technological worldview that you created. And so that circles us around. But the point of body cognition is not just as a counter, as to be a smartass to neuroscientists and substance and soul dualists alike. It's to say that who we are is engaged in the world and irreducible to any one reductionist account, including that of Marxists who might try to reduce us or their political understanding to merely class and material, but rather to say we are in the world and it's action oriented, and the body is the primary lived sentience of consciousness itself. But that recognition means it comes with a danger and it comes with a responsibility, because the kind of cultural world we build, the kind of family life we have, the kind of way we plan our cities, and the way in which we go about, say, psychiatry and fitness and what we ultimately love, as St. Augustine would say, is what's going to determine how the human sees itself. And this kind of mechanistic account of the human has disastrous consequences, not just for silly dreams of technocrats, but also for people in their everyday experience who don't understand why their lives are so unhealthy as they are.
Yeah, that's an interesting place to end up, actually, because I think in a sort of meta level, at a meta level, it's sort of embodying like what the critique is of AI in the first place, which is that you can't really separate the inside from the outside. You can't separate the belief from the consequences of the belief. And how the belief in strong AI affects us, I think, is like ultimately the criterion for whether it should be believed. I guess this is just because I'm a epistemological pragmatist myself, but I think that's a good way to sort of get into it. But I think it's also worth pausing over the kind of like analytical aspect of it as well, which you've set up very well. And I think it's interesting the way that the proponents of strong AI kind of frame this, because the idea is to explain something like love or like a complex emotion, to explain that is just simply to explain the mechanism, and you get these sort of like interminable, like efficient causal explanations of what it is that actually causes love, like, you know, down to like the very low level explanation on at the level of biology. And the belief that this is a full explanation, but of course there's something left out of it. And what is it that's left out? It's the what it is to be-ness of experience. And I mean, this is sort of the where Searle's Chinese Room argument comes in. This is exactly what that's meant to explain. And it's interesting because you get sort of dualism, as you mentioned, which I guess that these folks would sort of push back on, probably for historical reasons as much as anything, where you get the example of the fielder that's, you know, trying to work out how to catch the ball. And if this fielder is just a sort of an AI machine, that this is something that's worked out in the head, and then that algorithm is served out to the body. But in the end, it's like from a biological perspective, at least if you're looking at humans, there's really no real distinction to be made between the mind or the head and the body. Like, you know, where does the brain end? Well, I mean, obviously, you know, it's encased within the skull, but the mind and the brain is connected to an entire network that runs throughout the nervous system that goes all the way throughout the body. And it's, you get this entanglement between cognition and the body itself. And I think that there's an interesting parallel here with the idea of thrownness, to sort of go back to Dreyfus and his Heideggerianism, that we're born into a time and a place. There's an entanglement there between the subject and the environment, whereby the subject is not just simply it's not just simply a brain that like exists as a matter of biology and evolution and all these things, that there's a cultural aspect to it as well. So you can't really reduce these things strictly just to the body or to the mind. And I think the brain in the vat idea, that, you know, consciousness is just basically the kind of software that it operates independently of the body, kind of has implications. And the implications, I think, are interesting. I think that there is actually an issue for materialism here. There's a kind of marriage or a compatibility between the idea of strong AI and a kind of idealism, the idea that ideas or thoughts are really the ultimate metaphysical reality. And it's interesting because I think we always have to ask, what is it that, what's the kind of framework within which these things are able to be thinkable? Like, how did we get here? You know, something like, as a historical example, the birth control pill was something that I believe the technology had been available for some time, and was known, or at least, like, you know, from a chemistry perspective, like, it was kind of known, but it had to wait. Like, this sort of had to wait until the cultural aspects kind of caught up with it and was able to make the idea of the pill thinkable. So I think it's interesting to think about what intellectual currents might have paved the way for the idea of AI and this kind of formalism of how the mind is sort of the main reality, and that the body kind of doesn't matter. And I think that it's ultimately something that is an outgrowth of liberalism itself, where you can see interesting parallels here between the idea of the formalism of AI and what Carlyle calls government by steam, which is the idea of the elevation of the abstract above the particular. It's, in a way, it's actually a kind of Platonism in the political realm. And the idea being that if you get the algorithm right, that the actual embodied man that's staffing the thing doesn't really matter. And it seems to me that this is kind of like ultimately the same issue as with AI and embodied cognition. But of course, in reality, the state's not just a set of formalized methods that, like, if it were followed to the letter, generate this functional social order. The state is something fundamentally agentive. Like, it's something that requires agency. It needs a real man at the helm. It's not just this kind of like automated process, or like a golem that, once it's set up and running, essentially like passes a kind of, you know, political Turing test for looking like a state. And this is exactly what liberalism seems to think the state is. It's something from which all human agency can actually be abstracted. And the strict constitutionalist being kind of the paradigm here. And this is not to say that like power shouldn't be formalized or anything, only that a formal, like, constitutional type system of checks and balances is necessarily like incomplete in a formal sense. Like, it can't self-interpret, as Joel had mentioned with language. It requires like a real life flesh and blood man at the helm that has will and agency and all these things presiding over it. And ultimately, like I say, it's a kind of Platonism where the abstraction is realer than the concrete instance, and the proposition on the piece of paper is the nation and the flesh and blood instantiations of it, like the people in the nation here and now. They're only political, or they're only like particular and transitory expressions of this higher form that exists independent of any instance. So I think that this is the sort of thing that would not have been thinkable in earlier times. And ultimately, AI is less of an argument. I mean, obviously, it's an argument for a certain kind of technological paradigm and singularity. But ultimately, what it is it's just another outgrowth of the environment from which it comes.
Building upon that, I think a deeper critique of it, and this critique is something that goes beyond AI to, I think, basically the entire structure of Western metaphysics, the ontological status of the model. We have this habit of thinking in terms of models in such a way that we can't think thought in any way other than as a model. And so we end up in this kind of circularity where, by trying to subordinate our understanding of thought itself to some model of how thought comes to rise, we presuppose the act of modeling in thought in order to get there. And this is a recursivity, because the very thing that you're trying to explain, you're engaging in all of these assumptions within prior to explaining it. And so, you know, the account of, or consciousness is a bunch of these material processes, consciousness is a bunch of relations between representations and so forth. I mean, the very act of modeling these things is the very thing that you're describing. And so you're kind of presupposing the very thing to get the job done there. Whatever kind of parameters you set up, you're going to end up fulfilling it, because you're doing the very thing that you're trying to explain. You are thinking, you know, as you're trying to account for it. And this is a pretty brutal paradox, really. I think ultimately there has to be an exteriority or a priority. You can't enter into this vicious circle with any tenability. This relates to, I guess, the critique of determinism that I gave earlier. But I think this goes beyond that, because in the attempt to make a machine that can think, we end up engaging in this act of instrumentalizing thought, subordinating thought to this functionalist account, presupposing that thought is constituted by a system. Because, you know, from the perspective of the engineer thinks in terms of systems. How do I compose a system to produce an outcome? And so we're going to presuppose that the thing that I'm trying to produce is itself built upon some systemic process that exists prior to it. where does this assumption come from? It can't come from anything but the very thing that is supposedly systematically constructed. And so I think systemic thought itself is something pivotal, because people always talk about the system, talking about the political order. Contemporary sociology is pretty much infused with cybernetics, i.e. systems theory, which obviously was developed originally in the production of robotics and computing. Now this has become the paradigm through which we try to understand society, and this systematic thinking, everything is subordinated to it. And I think this goes all the way back even to, you can find it in Aristotle, but you can particularly find it in modern metaphysics, like in Kantianism or something. You have this systematic structure of representation and a formal representation. It becomes composed through this process where we have to presuppose, well, it needs to have this part and this part and this part. Kant is almost like a metaphysical engineer composing the production of intelligibility out of all of these metaphysical components or concepts that he conjures up and plugs them all into each other. And this is all resting on the assumption that this is the only way in which you can think about these things. But obviously there is a directness, a givenness to experience. And I think this is ultimately what Heidegger's project, for all of its faults, was trying to get behind and outside this systematic thinking, this process by which we enter into this realm of abstraction, of set abstract identities, set functions in a model, as kind of like machinic thinking. Instead, this is ultimately where he kind of revises his concept of epistemology, replacing the notion of correspondence, that ultimately a truth is the correspondence between two structures or two identities. And like, well, if we can create some systematic account that corresponds, as you would describe much earlier, Tyler, in your example, where, you know, someone will express subjectively a certain emotion, and then neuroscientists would be like, oh, this part of the brain lights up on the scan, and then reduce the experience of that emotion to the physiological event that they've detected. This is an example of correspondence. We have this event, and we're just going to stick them together, as opposed to his replacement of this with the truth of disclosure or revealing, of which correspondence is just one of many modes of the revelatory. That truth comes in other shapes and sizes or other modes, other forms than merely correspondence. And so emotions reveal themselves in direct ways, rather than trying to create a model out of our thought that gets behind thought somehow to model it. Instead, going straight to experience and taking it in this holistic manner, as you described, all the indivisibility of the givenness of experience is, as soon as you start abstracting it and dividing it up and compartmentalizing it, which you necessarily have to do to build any model, you have to insert intervals and distinctions and create distinct identities that can be abstracted from one another in order to be brought back together into the systematic understanding, instead trying to receive it in a holism. I think this is the most obvious way to express this truth, is the thematic. You know, you can watch a movie. The movie can have a theme that nowhere is explicitly articulated. So if you think about The Matrix, there is no specific account in that movie of basically what it's driving at, which is, in my view, a critique of determinism, an affirmation of the human will and the human soul as having a quality of indeterminism that ultimately no artificial intelligence, no matter how powerful, will ever be able to predict. But of course, it's not just explained to you in this direct way. Instead, it's performed in this elaborate narrative, and there's all these different elements and processes. But you're supposed to receive this fundamental truth, which is the theme that carries together the entire trilogy. And it is affirmed in all kinds of places, but it's not affirmed anywhere specific, anywhere absolutely particular, but it's affirmed in general. But we can receive that theme. We can perceive this contextual theme, this wholeness to the narrative that is nowhere specific, but it's everywhere in the same sense that it is nowhere. And this is true as well, interpreting religious truth. The most profound things in life, they're received in this subtle, immersive, contextual, and complete way, this holism. This seems to be ultimately what's missing from any kind of systematic account, because systematic thinking must be reductive. And so you get this idea in sociology where society is basically built of ethical normativity. We have a whole bunch of ethical norms, and then people want to obey ethical norms because those ethical norms are the kind of operating system by which we become intelligible to one another as ethical subjects, ethical agents. And so we can become predictive to one another. We can understand who's doing things that are wrong, who are doing things that are right, where punishments come in. Basically, a set of intelligible norms about how to act in a society. This is all generated by ethics. And so sociology looks at this and reduces it ultimately to the systematic account. Well, why do these ethics exist? Oh, they exist in order to produce this sociological function, that sociological function. So the ethics have no substance in themselves. They have no meaning in and of themselves. There is no moral truth. They're just relativistic processes that are the outcome of what their model predicts. They make all these assumptions that society's a system, that systems have to operate in a certain way, and so forth. And then based upon those assumptions, everything must be fit back into those assumptions in this circular dogmatism. And it empties out, abstracts away, and chops up the holism of experiencing a moral revelation or a moral truth in its directness, and instead divides it up into this functionalist account whereby, instead of acting in an ethical way because it is the truth, because it is moral, and you experience this in this visceral, direct way, just in your humanity, instead, this is just contingent upon all of these socio-historical and institutional forces that you've been disciplined into and trained into. And not that this kind of analysis has no value, but ultimately, if you reduce to it, you completely lose the real in its most direct sense, and instead replace it with something that is always distant from you. And I feel like this is ultimately what AI is, and what contemporary society, the direction that it's going. And I'll throw it back to you, Tyler, just now, but ultimately this idea that we're locking ourselves within this self-referential epistemology, where we load our analysis with all of these assumptions, and then we subordinate everything to those assumptions, and then we say, oh, see, society fits our assumptions. And so it just ends up being all of these abstract markers that just point to each other. And then we then implicate ourselves. We describe society. We describe thought. We describe everything that makes up our humanity in these terms. And so we entirely subjugate ourselves to this self-referential circularity within our own model. And so then the logic that we presuppose governs this model, we then convince ourselves ultimately governs us and everything around us. And so in a certain sense, we erect this deity of a sort, which we've convinced ourselves dogmatically exists prior to us and is constitutive of us and explains everything about us and defines who we are, but that is ultimately a product of our very thinking.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's certainly a lot between you two to reply to there, but for the most part, I echo what you two are saying. Because it's one thing, of course, when we're talking about embodied cognition, the big important factor of it there is the ability to articulate a phenomenologically influenced and account, at least in, according to, to give that account on a way in which we'll be able to counteract and be able to deal with a lot of understandings of the human that you find in popular science, you find in new research and all this. It's a way to basically give you a deconstructive tool, but also not just that. It's also a way to put these ideas of a holistic view of the human into action when it comes to reforming the scientific paradigm itself, right? And I think what Joel's getting at is more along the lines of the phenomenological critique, which is, of course, he mentioned Heidegger, but it goes back to Husserl, which is the idea that essentially you're creating, and this is what he was combating at the time, a model called psychologism, where you're creating a model of the world or a model of experience or a model of anything you're trying to understand. And then you then inhabit those assumptions while the original everydayness, the kind of constitution that makes up that experience what it is, becomes lost in the process. So you end up stuck with all these false questions, basically, and false dichotomies. You get dichotomies between soul and body versus world, the mind and the world, these kinds of dualisms, which are ultimately irreconcilable in the end. And this is what that kind of model production ends up leading to. It ends up leading to these kind of quandaries that end up encapsulating and fading the human within them. And so this is why in its original inauguration, the phenomenological prospect was not just one of securing science on firmer foundations or understanding consciousness, but it was also an ethical one. Because when we're looking at the kinds of models that you find, again, in the social sciences, and you see this in the Dissent, right, too, across those who might have a more race everything oriented understanding, or those on the left who might have a more class everything understanding. It's not that these understandings are necessarily without merit, because obviously, as we say in embodied cognition, they play a role, but it's not the full story. Right? And so what you end up in is what Joel was describing very accurately near the end, which was which is for Jean-Luc Marion, the phenomenology of idolatry, essentially, which is where an idol is that which you erect and it claims and holds vision to the whole world, kind of like a painting, of which it's a very beautiful image, and it might make sense according to those frames that it's within, but it's ultimately blinding you from anything outside the frame. And so idols might not come out of an entirely false place, but they essentially take something and they divinize it into the whole picture. And so those kinds of models of human agency, or the kinds of freedom, or the kinds of a relation with the divine, or any other way of disclosing the world, if we want to use Heideggerian ways of thinking about this, ultimately become bottled up in the idol and become bound to it. And this is why we have very many political idols today. Like, you have Christians in America who are unwaveringly patriotic, or you have those who are unwaveringly on favor of the left side of politics. And ultimately you end up in these kind of dichotomies that you're not really able to think outside of liberalism, right? And so this goes back to what Imperium Press was saying. It's like, yes, this is, sorry, Mike, I don't know why I called you by Imperium Press. I was used to saying that before I knew your name. But anyway.
Well, Mike is Imperium Press. Yeah, he's the living embodiment of Imperium Press.
Yeah. No, it's just an abstract concept that's.
He has two heads IFRL, I can confirm.
Yeah. Well, that's pretty sweet, actually. But that would change your cognitive structuring, that's for sure. But, to go back to what Mike
said. Need two vats for his brains.
Oh, yeah. And a lot of electrodes. But to tie this in, though, is, see, when I gave a story with Descartes and tied it into dualism and postmodernism and the cognitive neuroscientific view, the computational view, tied these three things together. I mean, I'm only partly telling the truth, of course, because we could go back earlier than that, right? Like, you had in the debate, at the early modern period, you have this debate between essentially occultist or ritualistic notions of public space, basically the sense of when you're engaged in a technological project, you have to enter a ritual or religious or Christian space first, right? Because that's what's going to give you the freedom to not be constrained down to the model, basically. Well, the side that won out, which was the side ultimately of the Enlightenment, which was that is a mechanistic view where everything is modeled on mechanistic lines. And the freedom, the idea here is that mankind can have freedom insofar as he understand and model the world and therefore give a mechanistic picture of it. And then they could abstract themselves from their limitations because they can manipulate the world around them. And so people that had this view tended to be more deist, right? The idea that God made the world, set up these laws, and then doesn't engage in it in a personal way. Right. And so there's a sharedness here that you see as a precursor to liberalism, which arises again with the time of absolutism. But you can even go back further than that as well, right? We could talk about Gnostic notions of salvation, that of the world is an evil place created by a lesser god, and the way to reach salvation is by freeing your soul with the knowledge of the true reality beyond, basically, right? And this was the dispute between the early church and the Gnostics, was the sanctifying of the physical world is what gives you freedom, the kingdom of God to move within the world according to who you should be and a healthy way to live. In other words, the sanctifying grace of the kingdom of God versus the abstracted idea of the soul escaping from the degraded material world and ultimately into one of abstract freedom. And so these, we could go even further than that, but regardless, the shared aspirations you see in liberal societies now goes back to a very anti-Christian, anti-God, revenge against the divine, revenge against the creator, idea that we can therefore escape our limitations by merely understanding the world and not being conformed to the will of God as created beings, right? So what we have here then is what's this model that we're constructing, and this is why I think phenomenology is so important, especially if you're going to engage in so-called dissident political projects, even though I don't really like that term, is because you unwittingly end up wrapped in these kinds of models, and you're wrapped in debates that even prefigure liberalism. And you're wrapped in an understanding that is binding you to destructive models of human nature, right? And they're the same ones that are making it so freedom of choice, for example, when you're abstracted from so-called biological, cultural, or traditional circumstances. And then you can then therefore realize your so-called true self, which is, again, this is the Gnosticism rearing its head. This is this shared connection between technological aspirations that binds the transhumanists and the so-called blue-haired feminists, right? And so I think that this ultimately comes down to a clash between two worldviews, one which is embodied, one which sees the created order as involved and sustained by God, and that this kind of ritualistic cleansing of the physicality of the world, of the models, doesn't bind you to idols, but instead to an icon, right? And so these are fundamentally theopolitical questions at the end of the day.
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring in deism. That was actually something that that I had thought on as well, in terms of sort of the theopolitical parallels between AI and embodied cognition, or AI rather, and liberalism ultimately. I think that this is something that, you know, these things, ideas like metaphysical ideas, they have downstream consequences, and the consequences kind of tend to come out in these weird ways that seem abstracted from what they were originally, but are ultimately just sort of recapitulating the original idea. And I think it's possible to bring in a kind of at a left field here, a fascist kind of critique on the lines of political theology, where, I mean, just to sort of set it up, ultimately the enemy for liberalism is something like the absolute monarch, or what it would consider the tyrant, right? And basically what this is it's a sublimated theology, a sublimated theological confrontation, ultimately. So like liberalism is really no less theological than anything else. And I think we can kind of bring in here Carl Schmitt's idea of decisionism and how that sort of relates to the abstraction of agency away from, well, in his case, the political realm. But this also has, you know, that's sort of the midpoint between the abstraction of agency of the individual and the abstraction of agency of the world in terms of abstracting God away from it, as in deism. So for Schmitt, his decisionism, the idea, for those who are not familiar, that the sovereign is the one who decides the exception. For Schmitt, the decisionism is the return of the miracle to the world. And it's not just the return of the miracle to the world, but the return of the presence of deity in the world. So something like the absolute monarch, or the Führer, or the God Emperor, especially the God Emperor, because that's explicit, is the return of the presence of God in the world. And you can set this as against constitutionalism, which is really the political expression of this deism that we're talking about in terms of AI abstracting away agency. It's the banishment of the sovereign. And the banishment of the sovereign in terms of constitutionalism is just the banishment of the deity. It's just that it's been sort of sublimated one level sort of beyond that. The constitutional monarch, you know, which in a way is almost a sort of contradiction in terms, this constitutional monarch being a sort of like deus otiosus, or a resting god that sets the world in motion, where it like runs like clockwork, that is, you know, via the constitution. And then this god steps away and just leaves it to run on its own forever. And this deism is sort of like the polar opposite of the work of the god man with his flesh and blood, like presence in the world. And this is absolutism there, or, I mean, absolutism is kind of loaded with historical connotations. So if you don't like that, you know, we can consider that, you know, the legitimate sovereign. And this is ultimately above all, what liberalism opposes, not just the king, but the god king or the god emperor. And liberalism is still obsessed with this figure, with the tyrant or the dictator or the absolute monarch or the Führer, whatever you want to call them. And all of these sort of remain for liberalism an essential religious category, especially the tyrant, which is itself a religious term in the beginning and still remains so. And I think this sort of ties in with what Joel was saying about indeterminism, where ultimately the decision is where the determinism breaks down and agency steps into the picture. So this is sort of a Bodanian notion of what it is to be sovereign, which is to stand above the law, to stand above the framework of the the law of causality, shall we say, where at some stage the buck has to stop somewhere, and where that stops is with the sovereign, where he stands above the law and is the one that actually it not only interprets the law but is able to be a lawgiver in a way. And this is basically where we can sort of bring in something like metaphysical libertarianism, where the subject that is not bound necessarily just by the formal aspect of what AI is trying to represent, this is where the subject kind of steps in and is able to assert his legitimate agency. So and ultimately I think the attempt to banish that is the attempt to banish God from the world, or deity from the world. So really what we're getting with AI is just a sort of roundabout, very, very complicated sort of circularity, as Joel mentioned, where it's just sort of recapitulating its own assumptions that it starts with, and that these sort of have many, many, miles downstream, sort of just come to restate what was assumed in the first place at a metaphysical level.
I think it's potentially more pernicious even than just that as well. I think it's ultimately a prison that we construct around ourselves out of our own delusions. I mean, particularly with the development of robotics, if you have a bunch of algorithms recursing back on themselves that automate all of these expressions of robotics that subjugate the human in a physical sense, we are engaging in this self-imprisonment, this kind of self-annihilation. I think also in the other sense, more so than even just self-annihilation, the problem that I have with Schmitt's decisionism is that he gives just like an empty form without content. And I get that that's the idea. The idea is that the content is supplied by the event of the decision, which is a pure affect without cause. But ultimately, from the perspective of the person making the decision, that event has an intelligibility. That event isn't like some totally like a void out of which he just manifests something out of nothing. But that event ultimately has a sense. And sovereignty doesn't act as a kind of random, arbitrary event, but in response to a sense, a genuine idea, a genuine theme that is possessing the individual who makes a genuine decision and possessing the context of that decision. This gets back to the thematic holism that I was talking about earlier. I think this is where it all fits back into what Tyler was saying about theopolitics, which is the idea that divinity is a context. It isn't just simply an event. And so this relates also to an idea of Adam Katz. He's been bringing up in his recent writing of staging. But ultimately, yes, someone must occupy the center, someone must preside over the political order and act as a final arbitrator in a formal sense. But ultimately, that role is staged. In other words, that role is made intelligible. We actually have to know who's in charge. And when they tell us to do something, we have to know what they mean. It has to be interpreted by various other intermediary authorities so that they can actualize what's being commanded in a way that honors the original commandment. And so there is an epistemological process by which the decision is translated and interpreted and manifested in the world. And this process is a process which also stages the sovereign so that the sovereign is in a position to make another decision again next time an exceptional event occurs in which some kind of radical act that reconstitutes the intelligibility of the political needs to occur. And so this process is complex and relates back to itself. And what's compelling about this is that epistemology presupposes morality, because you can't have any kind of practical epistemic process which is insincere. Otherwise, intelligibility breaks down, at least the assumption. Yeah, there's a series of moral assumptions that go into participating in a process of discovery. You have to believe the other person is telling you the truth. You have to believe mutually in a set of presumptions. And so, you know, it's tempting in many ways to call liberalism nihilistic and modernity nihilistic and all of these things. And I think it is in some ways. Progressivism and mass democratic ideology, these things are nihilistic in a certain sense, but they also have a certain universalism, certain sacred cows which we don't question. They are ultimately paradoxically relativistic because they are kind of relativism itself, the idea that the democratic process is itself sacred, meaning that the consent of the governed is sacred, that somehow the ritual of democracy actualizes radical equality, that ultimately my vote, your vote, and anyone else's vote is radically equal, and the implication that this goes beyond merely when we enter the ballot box in the ritual, but that our radical equality extends beyond this, and this feeds back into woke ideology, this idea, well, if blacks are underrepresented as university professors, this is because of racism, not because of any other factor. There can't be any inherent difference within blacks that gives itself over to this situation, and so it must be due to racism and discrimination and so forth. Or, you know, when someone puts on a dress and, you know, wears lipstick, they become a woman. There's nothing inherent to them that makes them a man or a woman. It is simply a decision, a role. Everyone has a radical equality to participate in different social categories. They have no essence. They have no substance. And so these are forms of sacredness. This is why you're seeing people describing woke ideology as like a quasi-religion of sorts. This is grounded ultimately in, I think, the ethical normativity of epistemology, the intelligibility of democracy, the intelligibility of secularism and relativism can only make itself known in a politically actionable way in this way. There would be no other way in which all of these things could be intelligible. And so I think this gets to the very core of what liberalism was, which is it ejected us into this position where the decision became this empty form without content. So in classical liberal theory of John Locke or Adam Smith or something, you have, you know, John Stuart Mill, you have this like utilitarian calculation that occurs within the individual who John Locke describes as like a blank slate, this empty form, you know, without content. And then some kind of rational apparatus processes inputs into some kind of utilitarian calculation, and this manifests itself in the logic of the market. So this process was occurring at a time when it was kind of given that the majority of society were Christians, that monarchies were still existing at this time. There were all of these pre-established traditions and ways of living that were just given. No one needed to create a philosophy that justified them because they were just how things were. A lot of these philosophies were created by reactionaries in the face of liberalism beginning to liquidate them, but they didn't have to be explicitly articulated prior to this in a formal sense because they were just inhabited as ways of living, as ways of being that were just assumed. And so as liberalism begins this process of liquidating and abstracting away the individual and his decision from tradition, eventually he becomes emptied out, and you get to, you know, the late 19th, early 20th century where we have these emptied out individuals that are pure formal entities, pure functions that have no substance, no content. And so the only way to fill them back up was by filling them up with their substancelessness, with their relativism itself, with their contentlessness itself, in the production of the liberatory, where we can become liberated from capitalism, liberated from gender, liberated from all of these forces. And this became the logic of a new bureaucratic epistemology, where now the bureaucracy existed to facilitate actively this process of liberation through the scapegoating of whiteness, of Christianity, etc. I think this really drives at the essence, which is that, you know, in this attempt at trying to create this self-description of society, whereby society is understood in terms of a model of itself rather than just received as given by tradition, given by God, given by our ancestors, where everything becomes subject to a rationalization and a model explicitly in a formal sense rather than things being left implicit. The staging of authority being done in a way which is subtle, which is more performative and thematic, and almost more like a drama than a science. In the process of rationalizing these things, formalizing them, abstracting them, the description of society became subject to its own process of rationalizing, of the attempt at describing itself in this paradoxical fashion. And so it became locked in this circular self-reference. And this is the same self-reference that AI is a symptom of, basically trapped in this self-instrumentalization of infinite recursion that is the consequence of rejecting the revelation of epistemology, that our decisions have intelligibility by their reference to their staging, by tradition, our ethical norms, our way of life given by a divine source. We have various prophets and holy books and traditions and institutions like that reveal this to us.
Right. Well, yeah, there's really a lot to respond to, but well said. I was going to say on the question of Schmidt that Mike brought up, which I think was a very apt person to insert here at this particular time, is because one of the things about Schmidt's decisionism that you find in his later work, which we just did an episode on this actually on Nomos of the Earth, is that in his later stuff, he kind of focuses more on the embeddedness of law and the context in which the gathering and making form out of an undifferentiated mass of the earth is the basis of the law in which that decisionism actually manifests and makes sense in. Although I would say Schmidt also ends up with the trouble of believing in the myth of religious violence, essentially, which allows him to be uncritical about secularity. He's certainly critical about liberalism, but the process of the nomos of the earth, in which he fails to describe the new nomos of the earth, I think largely has to do with his secular priors, despite being a Catholic. But he does become unwaveringly accepting of secularity as preferable during the time of absolutism, right? And the advent of the jus publicum europaeum, right? And so I think Schmidt is a good indicator in this direction, but he does tend to be a bit limited by that. But regardless, he does get at the embedded nature of law, which of course goes back to the critique of AI with embodied cognition, right? And I think to tie what Mike and Joel are saying together with the question of theopolitics and the question of phenomenology is that all honest phenomenology ends up becoming religious phenomenology, essentially, even though putting the religious in front of it doesn't sound like it's something you should do, it's because it's simply phenomenology. But regardless, when we're talking about issues that phenomenology runs into when it destroys essentially the models of the earth by returning to their originary constitution and describing them as modes of experience from the body to the brain to the environment to the traditional, to the intersubjective, and to notions of affectivity as well, is that these aren't so much static traditions or traditions that are simply received and something which by the act of decision or an act of will or a creative genius constructs these kinds of traditions, but rather what we have is, and what we run into, is a notion of saturated phenomenon, which is another one of John Luc Marion's terms. But this is where, when you start to return to the originary experience of the world, and you start returning away from modeling, and you start talking about the generative advent of traditions and the like, and your everyday experience with the world, be it along the lines of abstracting and adding, say, a mathematical model or something, basically, you end up with what's called the saturated phenomenon, which is where there's phenomenon of such overwhelming givenness of the world that they simply cannot be captured by models. And in fact, we end up creating new systems, right? And this relates to our juxtaposition of the icon versus the idol. With the idol you have, which you find in a lot of answers in politics and distant right, which solely relate solely to one factor of humanity, say they race, class, genetics, or something like that, is they tend to tell a truth, but then obscure everything else outside the frame. So then that essentially becomes just a reflection of yourself, which in a way is already bound to that modeling of the world that came prior to it, right? And so when phenomenology runs up against the icon, which is the icon of Christ, is that there's an overwhelming givenness and an overwhelming reliance of the creature on created being into participation with the divine life itself, that at the foundation of religious and spiritual experience, even though I really like to separate religious, but regardless, is this relation with a self that can't, by acts of mere mental intentionality, construct a model about them. This is where you get questions of apophatic theology and the like, right? And so to tie this back to politics then, is what we end up with is, with a theopolitical question, is a theology that accounts for politics that's more radical than political philosophy. Because when you're dealing with political philosophy, political science, you're effectively dealing with this creation of disciplinary independent spaces that act according to their own rational laws that you can then control and manipulate. It's the same as basically everything else in modernity. But when you add the theopolitical dimension, you're talking about an overwhelming givenness, which is what motivates you, your political thinking, past these kinds of realms of necessity, right? So just to make this sound concrete in a way that's applicable to the audience, one thing you see often a lot in radical politics is they'll say something like, well, the church can't be a solution because it's overwhelmingly positive. Or you might say we can't end mass immigration because neoliberal technocrats have a monopoly on everything and decision making. Or you can't wake up the masses or direct the masses in any way because you don't have power, et cetera, et cetera. Now, the thing is all these things are based on making rational predictions that are basically leaving you with one option, which is to abstract from society and create an independent community, which is not realistic nor practical, nor is it really independent. Right. So, but what this is why a lot of political solutions end up in trouble is that they let the whole coordinates of the system, which is coordinates of potentiality, effectively dictate and control and rationalize not only the present, but what the future is going to be. And it's going to limit your modes of action. It's going to limit effectively revival or limit revelation and limit the event. And really what it is a way of letting your enemies control everything that you aim to do and aim to accomplish, so much that there's no sense of radical break or radical action that could actually become outside of the coordinates of the system. But when we bring in notions of revelation and saturation, those which actually created with the original revelation of Christ into the church, is that we're talking about a notion of kingdom of God that is here but always coming, right? And this is what restructures and renews and creates renaissances in our understanding that could return it and go beyond our current limitations of modeling and effectively destroy the apparent but not actual necessity of the progressive liberal worldview. And so this is why questions of phenomenology end up in religion, and religious questions, if you take them seriously, end up in theopolitics. Because ultimately, at the end of the day, what matters is who is going to be master. Is it going to be the rationalized, bureaucratic, abstracted, progressive, this is a necessary origin, and are you going to orient all your political actions around that? Which so many people do, effectively. They just become, all their actions become contingent, but what they're combating becomes necessary, even if they don't acknowledge that's the case. Or you talk about a radical saturation of the self, your body that's the brain, the body, the environment, the world, the community that's integrated together and affects a change in one, affects a change in the other, comes up against notions of the divine and the createdness at the center of the world, which moves and pushes and destroys those very same idols. So this is why, at the end of the day, these questions end up being theopolitical questions.
Yeah, I think that's a good place to sort of kind of start wrapping up the conversation, because I think we've kind of come full circle to a place where these things are ultimately not separable from each other. So something like AI, which seems like a very, you know, it's a technocratic question, it is ultimately related to theology, and that we have to view these things in a kind of holistic manner. Myself not being no friend to metaphysical monism, I do think that we have to carve reality at the joints and say that these things are different, and these things are ultimately the same, because that is how we have to look at them. And ultimately, theology with the question of embodiedness, these things are very much linked up together. And I think what we're seeing here with AI and the disembodied nature and constitutionalism and formalism in a certain sense is just an expression of the disdain for immanence in the world, that in the worldness, or what it's like to be a thing in the world. And what we're seeing here, with, you know, with the alt-right and the dissident right and what came before it, as well as what's going to follow it, what we're seeing here is kind of the rebirth of something that's actually quite ancient and maybe even something primitive in a way. It's a fundamentally a religious expression of immanence and hopefully, and I believe this, to be true, the return of the immanent deity to the world. And I think we can see this in the sort of like the imperial cults of the pre-Christian world. But these are just sort of like latent distorted expressions of the ancestor cult. And we could also see this in the figure of Christ himself, the sovereign, literally God on earth, the word made flesh, come to preside over his kingdom and reign as a real flesh and blood man, something embodied ultimately. What we're seeing here is a sort of revolt against the disembodied, abstracted, platonic nature of what has come to prevail in the modern world. And this is very healthy development, and I think it's a question that needs to be considered further. And Tyler, thank you for chasing this up and bringing this to the table, because I think the embodiedness and embeddedness and concreteness of your take on AI is something that we can really, really use at this point. So thank you very much for that. And Joel, did you have anything else that you wanted to say, or any final parting words?
Yeah, I guess like the final word is that ultimately, in rebelling against the concept of divinity itself by trying to create a model that references itself out of its own act of creation, in an act of sleight of hand, is this paradoxical attempt to create a god where the vision, the sci-fi vision of AI, is omnipotent, omniscient, or approaching omnipotent and omniscient being, and that this is an intense irony that it's almost as though we're building what the Gnostics called the Demiurge.